Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take another look at Ted Bundy. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for The Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast True Crime. You can find me on most social media platforms under one of those monikers. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, follow the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, as well as exclusive content, just like my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony did. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Left off last time, Ted Bundy had just escaped on December 30th, 1977. He ends up in the Sunshine State of Florida, specifically the Tallahassee area, where he acquires two different sets of identification. Both of the men that Bundy picks are students of the local college, Florida State University. And he had settled on two different sets of identification: Kenneth Meisner, who was a graduate student at the college, and Chris Hagen, who was also a student on the college. And it's never really been explained, so far as I'm aware, how Bundy was able to get all of the information that he was on these individuals. By his own accord, he did extensive research on both of these men, including into their backgrounds, their families, places of birth, that type of thing. And he's really able to assume their identities as he settles into a boarding house that's kind of on the edge of the college campus called The Oak. Bundy is able to get IDs in both of these men's names. He also stated that his overall plan was to get multiple sets of IDs made in different names, starting out with American citizens before getting some made in the name of Canadian citizens so that he could eventually flee to that country. He said that his plan was simply to blend into the background, become a non-entity, get a job, and figure his way from there. We know that he had roughly $500 when he escaped from Colorado. From what, as I understand it, most of this money was gotten to him by Carol Ann Boone, and that his whole goal was simply to be a law-abiding citizen and to enjoy his freedom. But as we're going to see, it's not going to last long. Very quickly after Bundy gets to Tallahassee, he begins a series of petty thefts, stealing women's credit cards from their purses in supermarkets or anywhere else that he can get them, stealing things such as television sets and stereos, along with various vehicles along the way, although Bundy did state that his plan really was to lay low. He was going to get a bicycle and either ride that bicycle wherever he needed to go or walk. Stories of Bundy's travel from Colorado to Florida differ. Some state that he stole a car in Chicago and drove it to Atlanta, and then from Atlanta he stole another car and headed down to Florida. Others state that he ends up in Michigan and steals a car there, which he drives down to the Tallahassee area. In any event, by January 5th, Bundy is in Florida, laying low, trying to enjoy his newfound freedom. And we've discussed this in other cases where towards the end of their careers, a killer will start to get sloppy and will start to spiral out of control. And that's really what we're going to witness with Ted Bundy. I mean, honestly, that's the only way to realistically look at what he is about to do in the state of Florida, is that he spiraled out of control and was unable to control the malevolent, sadistic, and homicidal compulsions that drove him, at least as far as we're aware, for the entirety of his life. Bundy would later state in various interviews that during this period of time, he knew that he should, in fact, be out looking for work, as he only had a month to come up with $320 to pay the landlord of the Oak on February 8th, but just simply being free seemed like the only thing that mattered to him, and enjoying the simple things of life that he had enjoyed prior to his incarcerations in Utah and Colorado really became the focal point of his life. Going to the library, playing racquetball, sitting in at various classes at Florida State University. All of these things that so many people take for granted, Ted seemed to revel in doing each and every one of them, and the days very quickly slip by. What is often not talked about is the fact that Bundy was stalking women while he was down in the Tallahassee area. We know this from hints that he dropped during his later incarceration, that this was part of his modus operandi, and it was a part that most people are usually unaware of. Yes, a lot of his targets were random. However, not all of the women that Ted Bundy killed were randomly targeted. He stated during various interviews that some of these women simply caught his eye, and he intentionally followed them, learned their habits, learned their various schedules, and would strike when the moment seemed right to him. What do I mean by studied them? To the best of my knowledge, Ted Bundy never stated that he followed these women for weeks on end. He simply was an apex predator. He would see a prey, and he would learn their various habits, whether it was over a day or two or, you know, 4 or 5 days before he struck. There is evidence that some of the crimes that he is going to commit in Florida fell within this MO, especially the Chi Omega crimes that we're going to get here in just a moment. In Florida, Bundy changes his look again, keeping his hair cut short, combed flat. He begins to grow out a mustache, and once again, he is the chameleon who is blending into the background. Ted Bundy later lamented to various law enforcement officials that the one thing he found unbearable while in Florida was how lonely he felt. He knew no one, no one knew him. He couldn't tell anyone of his background, and he really was unable to go out and make friends, as this might expose him and therefore lead to his capture. So Bundy spent the majority of his time wandering the Florida State University campus, talking to a band that lived in the boarding home that he lived in, as well as one of the women that lived there. And his nights
ensconced in his bedroom watching television and drinking beer. And that's something that a lot of serial killers have discussed when talking about their crimes. A lot, but not all, have stated that drinking or taking mind-altering substances, i.e. drugs, lowered their already non-existent inhibitions and allowed them to commit the horrendous acts that they did. Point of fact, Carol Durantia, the woman who had attempted to be kidnapped in Utah, stated that the man who accosted her and got her into the car had a fairly heavy scent of alcohol on his breath. And others who encountered Bundy noticed this as well, that he would have this, you know, that boozy smell that comes off of people who have been imbibing. And Bundy will later claim that alcohol and pornography were the root cause of everything that he did. I'm not saying Ted Bundy may not have had a problem with alcoholism, but to pin all of the horrendous things that he did on that disease is, again, very characteristic of not only Ted Bundy, but of serial killers as a whole. They cannot put the blame on themselves for their actions. It's always someone else or some outside force that led them to this thing. Gerald Stano, when he was questioned by police, almost universally stated that each of his victims had insulted him in some manner, which led to him raping and murdering them. Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, told similar stories about some of his victims insulting him in some way, which would trigger him to commit these murders. There's no way to know for certain whether or not this is true, as nobody was there who survived other than the killer, and we only have their word to take for it. And if you take the word of a serial killer as the gospel truth, you're a fool. They're notorious liars who will say anything to shift the blame and to make themselves appear to be not as bad as they actually are. About a week after arriving in Tallahassee, Bundy is back to his old practice of predator and prey. This time, he really expands his activities, going from singular attacks to what is seen as one of the most barbaric crimes in the state of Florida, that of the Chi Omega murders, which took place on January 14th, 1978, about a week after Bundy arrived in Florida. Now, Chi Omega House was a very large building filled with young, beautiful college girls, as well as a house mother. The girls lived on the second and third stories in double bedrooms, had communal bathrooms, while the first floor had a foyer with a main staircase, a rec room, a formal living room, a kitchen, and two staircases that led in from the back. One of these staircases led into the kitchen. The other staircase went from the recreational room up to the sleeping quarters. In addition to the sorority girls and the house mother, there was one male who was allowed both inside of the house and upstairs, and that was the houseboy, Ronnie Eng, who as I understand it, basically did various maintenance tasks around the building. He was generally well regarded by the girls living there, although he was seen as slightly weird. So on the night of January 14th, the majority of the girls are out of the sorority house attending various parties and keggers across the campus. A number of them have gone to a club that is right next to the sorority house called Sherrod's. One of these young women was named Lisa Levy, and it's known that by roughly 10 p.m. that night, she had left the disco and returned to the sorority house, specifically to her bedroom, which was in room number 4. A number of Chi Omegas were at Sherrod's that evening, with a good majority of them leaving between 2 and 2:15 a.m., and they later informed the police that they noticed the back door to the Chi Omega house, which had a combination lock on it, wasn't working properly, and that this had been something that they had been aware of for a few days. They had made both the house mother and the house boy aware of this fact. The girls come in, they go up to their rooms, other girls are returning from dates that evening, and this next part is very important as it gives us something of a timeline of events that we need in order to try and construct what is about to happen. At 2:35 a.m., Margaret Bowman said goodnight to Melanie Nelson. Melanie later told authorities that she looked at her digital clock before turning off her light for the evening, and it was 2:45 a.m. At 3 a.m., Nita Neary, accompanied by her boyfriend, arrived at the Chi Omega sorority house. Now, Nita had been out that night at a kegger with her boyfriend, although she'd only had a few beers as she had a cold and wasn't feeling well. Now, according to Nita, when she arrived at the back door to the sorority house, she found it standing wide open. Normally, this would be cause for alarm, but as all the girls inside of the house were aware of the issues with the back door, she didn't think anything of it beyond the fact that one of them had closed it and it had not latched all the way. So Nita goes inside, makes her way to the rec room, and starts turning off the lights downstairs when, as she later testified, she heard a loud thump from somewhere. Thinking that her boyfriend had tripped, she ran to the window and saw him casually getting into his car. Seconds later, Nita hears the sound of running footsteps in the hall above her and freezes. She's able to get herself moving again and makes her way through the rest of the rec room, pausing where the rec room meets the foyer, and she's looking out into the foyer, which is lit by a large crystal chandelier. Anyone who has ever been in a house of this type understands that while it throws light, chandeliers generally don't throw the type of light that is going to light a room up blindingly bright. Instead, it throws a sort of muted yellowish light. And as she's standing there looking into a foyer, a slender man wearing a black jacket, black pants, and what she later described as a toboggan-type hat, which is basically one of those winter ski hats, you know, like the kind that night watchmen wear, comes running down the steps. He has the hat pulled down over the top half of his face, and she later stated that the only distinguishing feature she was able to make out on the man was a sharp nose, and she initially thought that it was the houseboy Ronnie Eng.
although later Nita would inform the police that the man seemed to be taller and huskier than Ronnie. The man waits a few seconds before opening the front door, running out into the night, closing the door behind him. Nita is standing there, frozen for a second, before she runs upstairs to wake up her roommate, Nancy, telling Nancy what she has just seen. And the two girls are terrified. Nancy grabs an umbrella and they make their way back downstairs. They check both the front and back door, and both of these doors are locked, at which point they return upstairs, trying to figure out whether they should wake the house mother or they should contact the police. When they see a woman by the name of Karen Chandler come stumbling out of room number 8 and head in the opposite direction of them, the girls run after Karen and are horrified to discover that Karen, who's holding her head, her face is covered in blood. So Nancy brings Karen back to their bedroom where she's trying to tend to her. Well, Nita goes and wakes the house mother and then heads back towards room number 8 on her own. Inside room number 8, there's another young woman by the name of Kathy Miner. Kathy is sitting in bed, holding her head, gushing blood from head wounds and moaning unintelligibly. As Nita's making this discovery, Nancy Doughty is on the phone with police. She was said later by detectives to be hysterical, and that the only thing they were really able to make out was that there were two girls fighting over a boyfriend at the Chi Omega house. At 3:23 a.m., a patrolman arrives at the sorority house, and not long after that, more members of law enforcement as well as paramedics begin to arrive on the scene. Officers are taking a statement from Nita downstairs as she describes to them the man that she saw in the foyer. An all-points bulletin is put out for an individual matching that description, while upstairs, the house mother and at least 10 of the sorority girls are with the two known victims, Kathy and Karen. Both of the girls have extensive head wounds, broken jaws, teeth knocked out, that type of thing. And officers began to investigate the rest of the upstairs, as there's a number of girls who are unaccounted for. Inside room number 8, the walls were covered with blood spatter. There were pieces of bark covering both of the girls' beds, as well as copious amounts of blood. It was learned that neither girl had any idea what had happened, as both of them were asleep when they were attacked. Now, some have speculated that there's no possible way Ted Bundy could have attacked both of these girls in the very same room without waking the other one up. While that is a possibility, we need to look at the fact that the individual responsible for this attack was in a frenzy, and he very well could have savaged the one girl and gone to the next so quickly that the other one did not have time to register the sounds that she was hearing. Or it could be that he ran back and forth between the two girls, beating them, you know, into unconsciousness, and as he had hoped, into death. However, we really don't know all the specific details, as not all of the confession tapes that Ted Bundy is going to give many, many years later have been released by the police that got these confessions. An officer ends up going down to the hall to room number 2, where Lisa Levy was. With the house mother close behind him, they go into the room. The house mother is calling for Lisa. There's no response. They turn on the lights, and at first there doesn't seem to be anything amiss. The officer goes over to wake Lisa, who has the covers pulled up to her shoulders, and as he's starting to turn her over, he notices blood stains on her pillow, at which point the paramedics are called for. Unfortunately, Lisa Levy doesn't survive. They find blood stains and bark all over her bed, along with her panties lying next to the bed. Lisa ends up having been sexually assaulted as well as murdered. Officers have a mistaken belief for a moment that there is another victim when they go to awaken Melanie Nelson, who is sleeping in her room. However, she is just sound asleep and has no idea what has happened. The horror of the Chi Omega house is not done yet for that evening, unfortunately. They learn from Melanie that the only person thus far unaccounted for is Margaret Bowman. Melanie lets them know that, no, Margaret's home. I was in her room. We were talking. Margaret had gone to bed. She gives them the time. Melanie accompanies an officer down to room number 9. The officer goes in with Melanie behind him. He turns on the light and immediately shoves Melanie out into the hall, shutting the door behind him. Now, Melanie later stated that Margaret's door was slightly ajar, although she distinctly remembered closing it tightly behind her. Inside the room is a scene straight out of a horror movie, as the officer, upon turning on the light in the room, he saw Margaret lying face down and blood all over the top of his head, which made him shove Melanie out into the hall. The officer stated that he approached the bed, and as he approached, a sinking feeling was coming over him just by the way the girl was lying, as well as the amount of blood that he was seeing as it was bubbling up out of what appeared to be a crack in her skull. Reaching Margaret's bed, he looked down and saw, according to this officer, right into her skull where her brain was. He stated that this almost made him sick to his stomach, and despite all of this, he pulls the sheets back and attempts to raise Margaret up, although he thinks better of it, realizing that she's obviously dead. There's a pair of nylon stockings around Margaret's neck, which have been cinched so tightly they have actually cut into the skin around her neck and become entangled with a golden cross or crucifix necklace that she is wearing. Next to the bed, Margaret's panties are lying. She, too, has been the victim of a sexual assault. Some commentators have tried to point to the fact that two of the victims were sexually assaulted as proof that more than one person was responsible for the Chi Omega massacre. However, we know from his former fiancé that Ted Bundy was an individual who was able to experience multiple orgasms during intercourse. So it is not beyond the realm of possibility that Ted Bundy, in his bloodlust and frenzied assault, sexually assaulted both of these girls, just as it's not beyond the realm of possibility that Bundy did the same later that night. Now, officers learned, as all of these discoveries are being made, that a young woman who lived in room number 2 by the name of Carol Johnson had gotten home at roughly 2:55 a.m. and had discovered that the back door was ajar. When she went upstairs, she was startled to find that all of the lights in the hallway were off, which was something that was very uncommon. The hallway was generally lit as it is when you are in a hotel. She stated that she went into her room, nothing was amiss, before making her way towards the bathroom. Now, if you have ever been in a bathroom or in a room that has a swinging door on it, that's the type of door that doesn't latch, it just swings back and forth, kind of like a saloon door,
when someone walks past or a bedroom or a door, rather, is opened nearby, there tends to be a creaking and a swaying of the door. So as Carol is in the bathroom brushing her teeth, the door starts to creak as though someone moved past it on the outside. Although at the time she didn't think anything of it, she simply assumed that it was one of her sorority sisters returning home for the evening. Inside the house downstairs in the foyer, officers find small bits of bark that are similar to those found inside the rooms upstairs. They also discover a pile of oak logs out next to the back door of the house, and it's surmised that the killer had come in to the home at some point during the evening, although whether it was around the time the attacks took place between 2:45 and 3 a.m. or earlier in the evening, they are unsure. The officers also learn that earlier in the night at the disco, one of the young girls had noticed a handsome dark-haired man staring her down for quite a period of time, and that the man eventually had come up and asked her to dance. And she felt absolutely disgusted by the man, and after the dance was over, she commented to her friend that she felt like she quote-unquote had just danced with an ex-con. The girl is really not able to give a description of the man, and while the officers put it in their notes, there's really nothing they can do about it. Officers are continuing with their search of the house, unaware that roughly 8 blocks away, the same man is about to strike on Dunwoody Avenue. The house is called a shotgun house. Basically, it's a single-family home that has been divided into living quarters for 2 people in one. You have Debbie Cicerelli and Nancy Young, and on the other side, you have their friend, Cheryl Thomas. Now, all of these girls are really close friends. They visit back and forth, and basically, they know everything about one another. They have things in place to make sure that the other is safe. And on this evening of January 14th, the 3 girls, as well as Cheryl and a date, had gone to another club called Big Daddy's, with Cheryl leaving before Debbie and Nancy. Cheryl's date did not have a car, so she drives him home, arriving back at the house at roughly 1 a.m., with Nancy and Debbie arriving just moments later. The girls good-naturedly josh with each other before all of them going into their respective apartments. Now, according to Cheryl, after changing, getting into bed, and getting her kitten, she is awoken at some point during the night by a sound. She assumed that it was her kitten, which had gotten up onto the windowsill and had maybe knocked a plant down, although she does go back to sleep. Next door, Debbie is awoken at roughly 4 a.m. by what she stated sounded like someone was underneath the house using a hammer, although she quickly ascertains that the sounds are coming from next door. Debbie wakes up Nancy, and both of them hear these sounds, which they estimate to have lasted for roughly 10 seconds, after which there is silence. A few moments later, they hear what sounds like pained moans coming from next door. Obviously, Debbie and Nancy are terrified by this point. Debbie makes her way to the phone and calls her boyfriend, who tells her that it's probably nothing, they should just go back to sleep. However, Debbie feels in her gut that something is wrong, so she decides to call Cheryl. Now, the girls had in place that if the others were ever to call their apartment, they were to answer immediately, just to ensure that everything was okay. Debbie places this phone call to Cheryl's apartment, and there is no answer, at which time Cheryl and Nancy decide to contact the Tallahassee police, reaching dispatch at 4:37 a.m. As they're on the phone with dispatch, there is a loud crashing sound from what they assume is Cheryl's kitchen. Again, this obviously scares the shit out of the two of them, and they're telling dispatch about this as the room next door goes silent. Officers arrive very quickly. Debbie and Nancy let them know what's going on. One of the officers attempts to gain access through the front door. It will not open. It's locked. While other officers go around to the back of the house and see that a screen is off one of the kitchen windows, they relay this to the officers up front, stating that this window can probably be opened. An officer opens the window and is attempting to crawl through when one of the girls recalls that Cheryl had a key hidden above the screen door to her apartment. They get this for the officers, who then send the two girls inside. Officers make their way into Cheryl's apartment and immediately see her lying in the middle of her bed. There's blood everywhere. Nancy and Debbie hear the officers shout, "My God, this one's alive." And according to both women, at this point, they begin to bawl hysterically because now they know that their best friend, something serious has happened to her, although at this point, they have no idea what. In the apartment, the officers stated that Cheryl was twisting and writhing on the bed, her head covered in bruises and contusions, turning purple. Her top had been removed, exposing her breasts. And later, they would state that semen stains were found on the sheets, although they were of an indeterminate age and were unable to be linked to anybody, as Cheryl was known to have taken lovers before. You can't fault her for that, and I know that there are Bundy supporters out there who say this proves that somebody else did it, as this semen stain was unable to be matched to Ted Bundy. Fuck you guys for painting this young woman in such a horrible light. Doesn't matter whether Bundy sexually assaulted this young girl or not. The fact remains that Cheryl Thomas was savagely beaten, although she will survive this attack. So now we have two major crime scenes only 8 blocks apart. It's fairly obvious to officers that there's a good chance these crimes are connected. What evidence was found at the crime scenes? Well, at the Chiamega house, one of the victims had been savagely bitten on the buttocks. And this evidence is later going to be used as really the key piece of evidence that convicts Ted Bundy in the Chiamega murders. It should be noted that this type of evidence, bite mark evidence, has since been proven to be unreliable and is disallowed in most courts. The reason for this is that skin isn't a stationary object. It moves, it stretches, it shrinks when different factors affect it. And it's been found that when pressure, such as from bite marks or from an object breaking through the skin, is applied to it, it has a tendency to do all of these things and therefore distort the shape of the object, leaving the mark. So while they have this evidence, it's going to be used to convict him. If this case were to be tried today, that piece of evidence would not be allowed. Lisa Levy's nipple, believe it was her left nipple, was also found to have been bitten almost clean through, hanging on by a piece of tissue. She was also found to have been savagely sexually assaulted with a Clairol spray bottle, the kind with the spray top on it. and this was found to be covered with blood and fecal matter. Margaret Bowman was found to have been savagely assaulted. The ligature around her neck, the pantyhose, was embedded so tightly in her neck that it actually had to be cut away by officers or by the pathologist doing the autopsy. Cheryl Thomas, they have the semen stains. They also found, much to their surprise, lying beneath the bed covers, which were on the floor, a mask made out of pantyhose. Now, if you've ever seen any of the masks that Ted Bundy was found with, he would take the pantyhose, put them over his head, and then tie a knot in the legs, kind of giving himself a pair of rabbit ears. He would cut out the eyes around on the mask. And inside of this mask were found two brown hairs. Now, these hairs would later be linked to Ted Bundy. My contention has always been thus. If you know anything about forensics, you know that while hairs can be linked to a suspect with a certain degree of certainty, unless the root of the hair is present, it cannot be linked to a suspect with 100% accuracy. To the best of my knowledge, the roots of these two hairs were not found on the hair follicles, and therefore, while officers and pathologists could say that these hairs almost certainly came from Ted Bundy, they cannot absolutely say that. I'm not saying that Ted Bundy didn't commit these crimes, only that the hair follicles which were found could not definitively be proven to have come from Ted Bundy and no one else. At the Oak, two members of the band that lived there would later tell authorities that they arrived back on the morning of January 15th, at roughly 4:45 in the morning, to find the new man who had moved into the house, Chris Hagen, standing on the porch, staring out at the campus. They stated that he did not seem to be upset or in distress in any way, and simply had said hello to them before continuing to stare out at the campus. Later, they would state that the boarding house had been abuzz with news of the assaults, and that Hagen, nee Bundy, had said that it was pretty obvious that the individual who had committed these crimes was a professional and knew exactly what he was doing and had almost certainly left no evidence. These words would later be used on the witness stand to help convict Ted Bundy of these crimes. We are going to end the episode at this point. It is now January 15th, 1978. Two murders, three assaults have taken place in Tallahassee in the span of a few hours, and Ted Bundy is still on the loose and is continuing to spiral. I hope you guys have enjoyed this episode, and until next time, stay morbid.